This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Doesn't look like the perfect holiday, does it, from the video? A very warm welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival to you and to everybody here. Thank you for getting cosy and squashing in and hopefully making some new friends in the process. Lev, yeah, welcome back.
Thank you.
Himalayas, Americas, Nile, done, ticked, off. What was the draw of Arabia?
So I think, well, the genesis of this project actually goes back all the way to 2003. I was a 21-year-old backpacker on holiday in Egypt with my mate, and it just so happened to be, if you recall, the year of the Iraq war and so on. So we knew there was a war brewing over in the east, but we were quite happy having our Egyptian holiday. We then went into Israel and backpacked around there, and then something happened that kind of changed everything, and probably had quite a big impact on my later travels, because a bomb went off in Jerusalem, which meant that all of Israel's borders went into lockdown. And our original plan had been to take a boat from one of the port cities onto Cyprus, Greece, and then backpack home through Europe. But we were stuck. There was only one border left open, which was to the east, wrong direction entirely, but to Jordan. So we left Israel, went to Jordan, and then the next day another bomb went off, and this time in Baghdad, which meant that Jordan's borders were all closed. I mean, the whole region went into lockdown. This was the start of the insurgency and the backlash against the Iraq war. So I was in Jordan, and we didn't want to fly home because we didn't have any money, because we were poor students. And in any case, both of our parents thought that we were on holiday in Greece. No idea where we were. So we took the other option, which was the only other border that was open with Jordan, which was, of course, into Iraq, because it was, well, it was basically the Americans were on the border. So we went to the Iraqi border, and the American soldier on the gate welcomed us in, said no problem. He tried to sell us his gun. And we found ourselves in Baghdad, you know, in the summer of 2003, in that infamous year. And we ended up backpacking, basically, through Baghdad. We hitched a lift, and we were taken in by all sorts of characters. And it was a really formative journey for me. And it was probably quite reckless and a bit of an idiotic thing to do. But something stuck with me from that trip, which was the incredible hospitality and kindness of people, even in a war zone. The place that you kind of least expect it, actually we were shown an incredible welcome. And people wanted to look after us. And that might have been because we were young and stupid. But I think more importantly, you know, we were also British, and in a country where we were there when most Iraqis, you'd think, would not really welcome Brits. But that wasn't the case. And it stuck with me for the rest of my life. And actually, having done these previous expeditions, walking the Nile, the Americas, the Himalayas and so on, that's one of the themes that I've wanted to try and draw out, which is the kindness of strangers in, let's be honest, dodgy places. And I thought, for my next journey, why not go to the place that's got the most, probably the worst reputation of all, which is, of course, the Middle East. And in doing so, hopefully challenge some of the stereotypes about the region, because you only have to turn the news on, and it's all bad news, isn't it? It's ISIS, it's Al-Qaeda, it's terrorism. And even the most banal narratives rarely show the Middle East as anything other than one big empty desert filled with camels, you know. And so I wanted to look beyond that, look beyond the stereotypes, look beyond the headlines, and really explore a region and hopefully show people what the ground truth is like. And that's, it wasn't to avoid the conflicts, because they are there, and I show that, but also show the human stories and the amazing stories of hope and kindness that you get along the way.
Well, you start not in the frying pan, but kind of in the fire. You're about 50 miles from the front line where ISIS are in Iraqi Kurdistan.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I wanted to start on the Turkish border. So I actually started in Syria and then crossed into the Kurdish areas of northern Iraq. It was a place that I'd been to before as a photographer and a journalist. I travelled all across the Kurdish areas in particular. I'd been embedded with the Peshmerga. And so I wanted to sort of show their cause, but then move through federal Iraq, where the problems really started, because this was in the, well, it was in September 2017. So ISIS hadn't been defeated. Vast swathes of this country were still under ISIS control. And the only way to actually travel from Mosul down to Baghdad was to be embedded with the Iraqi paramilitaries, because it wasn't the Iraqi army that was doing the majority of the fighting. It was these basically volunteer units. The one that we were attached to was called the Hashid, which is basically a Shia paramilitary unit. These guys were just volunteers, civilians, who 4 years previously, their spiritual leader said, OK, we're going to declare a jihad against ISIS. Anyone welcome? And so you've got this ragtag bunch of militia soldiers armed with whatever they can pick up. And I was embedded with these guys as they were basically on the final offensive, the last 2 weeks of the war against ISIS, with them, seeing as they were clearing the villages, the towns, liberating cities. And it was a really historic and quite emotional thing to see, you know, particularly when you go into a village, the amount of destruction that's been caused there. But then when the people finally come out and the women, the children are thanking these people for rescuing them after 4 years of being occupied by ISIS was something, you know, quite profound. And I wanted to show that. And I did. And it was pretty... had a few hairy moments along the way, but literally we were on the front line, in the trenches, you know, as these Iraqi soldiers were kicking doors down and we, you know, we captured three ISIS commanders. It was quite something.
And as you say, there's a sort of jigsaw of groups and a jigsaw of individuals.
Yeah.
How did you know who to trust? Had that been thought about way before, or actually was there quite a lot of decision-making on the hoof as in that regard?
Well, you know, this is a place that you can't take lightly. This took sort of 2 years of planning. So to get into Iraq, you know, in the first place, we had to get all sorts of papers, permissions. So we knew we had to get a good guide. When I say we, there was myself, there was my mate Dave and Simon. That was it. Basically, this wasn't funded by any TV channel. This was something that we just did off our own backs and funded ourselves because I wanted to go and do this journey in particular. But we did it, and we got the right permits. But to do that, we had to get a really good guide in country. We ended up having a guy who, I wouldn't say he was good, but he certainly had access beyond anything that we... could have arranged ourselves, and this guy ended up being basically a spy within this paramilitary unit, and you know, he actually ended up, despite the fact that we didn't really get on, he actually got us this incredible access. What was quite surreal was being embedded in a unit of fighters, some of whom were the same people who were fighting against British and American soldiers not long before. You know, in Fallujah in 2007, in Basra in 2003, 2004. So, you know, I was embedded with these soldiers who had probably killed British soldiers along the way. In fact, I met this one guy. His name was Abu Tassin, who was probably the most famous and feared warrior in Iraq. You know, he had a bounty on his head for $250,000 by ISIS. He was 65 years old. He'd fought in every conflict since 1973. He'd fought against the Israelis in 73. He'd fought in the Iran-Iraq War. He'd fought in Iraq the first time round in 91 and Kuwait. He'd been in Bosnia, Chechnya, and he'd fought against the Brits and Americans in 2003 onwards. Mm. And he'd come out of retirement in 2014 to fight against ISIS as a sniper. So I sat down with this guy and interviewed him. And it was quite bizarre, you know, thinking this guy was formerly an enemy, I guess. But you have to kind of take yourself out of that mindset the only reason he allowed me to talk with him was when I told him that I had been a soldier myself. He said he didn't want to talk to journalists.
I wonder, I mean, you were in the paras, you didn't fight in the Middle East, but you did in Afghanistan. I wonder whether your attitude towards that whole region might have been different had you done a tour in Iraq.
Well, so my friend Dave that was with me as a producer, he had fought in Iraq. So it was... I think if you've got a certain amount of... If you can take yourself out of it and have a bit of awareness. I mean, soldiers are soldiers around the world. When you throw in the ingredients of fundamentalism and fanaticism, that's a different story. But if somebody is actually a soldier, you don't really, you don't take it personally, even if they're shooting at you.
So you've come down through that region and then into the Gulf, the Southern Gulf, which is a completely different story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the southern parts of Iraq were actually fairly safe. We went through the Iraqi marshes, which were beautiful, and then into Kuwait and then Abu Dhabi and Dubai. So it was bizarre having left this war zone to suddenly be in Dubai, staying at the Jumeirah Hotel. We went for a Friday brunch session. Has anyone done a Friday brunch session in Dubai?
Who's been to Dubai?
Yeah. I mean, we went there and it was Peter Andre on stage singing Mysterious Girl. So it was quite surreal to, like, see all of these different sides of the Middle East. And you know, Dubai was very different to when you cross over into Oman, which, again, is very different. That's like going back in time almost. Mm. So for me, this journey, it was very diverse, and that was the important thing, to show the diversity of not just of landscapes and the visuals, but also of the cultures and what is Arabia in the modern world. Because I've deliberately chosen this title because it's quite provocative. You know, what is Arabia? It sounds like this outdated Orientalist notion, but the reality is the people of the region are joined by a common language, more or less, and a common religion, more or less. But it was interesting to get the locals' perspective on what this region meant to them. And actually what I discovered was it's far more complicated than one could even imagine. The tribalism, the sectarianism, the legacy, not just of colonialism, but way back, you know. It was an interesting journey.
So Oman is perhaps, when we say the word Arabia, your experience of Oman is perhaps closest to that, in that you're in the empty quarter, and you've got a camel, or several camels, and a guide. And it's one of the first times in this journey, actually, in which you're walking, because, you're known for walking the Himalayas and the Nile and so on. Did it feel good to be back on your feet?
Well, I did. I wanted to make this less about the physical element. It wasn't about just getting from A to B and the sort of the endurance or anything like that. This was really an opportunity to be embedded with these different communities. But having said that, I couldn't resist the urge to want to walk across part of the empty quarter. So the tricky thing there was trying to find camels, because everywhere we asked in Oman, you know, we went to these Bedouin and said, can we borrow your camels or can you come with us? And they looked at me as if I was mad and said, why on earth would you want to walk? Why don't you get a car like everybody else? And that mindset has changed. The Bedouin, certainly in that part of Oman, they don't, you know, they've got camels as a status symbol, or they drink the milk, or they use them for meat, but they certainly don't walk across deserts in them anymore, you know.
But there's still a great affection for them, isn't there?
There's a great affection all across the region as an animal, but they're not used in the way they used to be, certainly in the empty quarter. I mean, when I went to the Dhofar, they do use them there for transport and going up
which
into the
is
mountains.
Southern
right
Iran,
on the southern,
yeah.
Southern tip of the country. And that, for me, was actually, the empty quarter was great, because I was kind of in my own mind sort of following a part of people like Thesiger's journey, and there's a real sense of vastness when you see this landscape. But it came with its frustrations. You know, the landscape, sadly, is pockmarked by oil refineries, and not just that, but, you know, you get these pockets of amazing sand dunes, but then you also see the trails left by the oil tankers and the cars and things like that. So I came away feeling a little bit disillusioned with that sense of the purity that I was kind of looking for there. But then, just as I had sort of given up on it, when I went to Dhofar, that was a totally different experience. The mountains, that the people there, the Jabali people, some of them, you know, they still live in these amazing caves. And then when you go to Yemen, that's a different story entirely.
Mm. Mm. Well, let's stay in Oman for a moment, because you're not the first British explorer to go out and say, well, you know, I want to be nostalgic for the desert, and it's a bit of a shame that oil's come along and people have got educated. I mean, Thesiger was famous for that and actually got a great deal of criticism, didn't he?
Well, I mean, you can't blame, you know, the people there for wanting the wealth that comes from the oil, of course. But it does have a huge impact on the environment and the cultures, and it has changed the culture quite significantly. So it's not a case of making a judgment whether it's good or bad, but if you go there looking for one thing and you find another, then
that's
what I was looking for, is to try and find the essence of what makes the region unique now.
Yeah. Are you conscious, and do you read about, or perhaps you read them on the journey, explorers who've gone before you, not just Thesiger, but even Batuta, Gertrude Bell, you know, Freya Starr?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's something that I've always enjoyed doing, reading about the explorers of the past.
History is what you read at university, isn't
it? I did, yeah. Particularly of this region, the Middle East and Central Asia, the Silk Road. So, yeah, that was definitely part of the homework. And of course, it's a very different experience now to go and try and do a journey in this part of the world or anywhere, you know, with that in mind. But there are just moments when you think, wow, that, you know, that could have been a scene that hasn't changed in hundreds, if not thousands of years. And that, you don't get it everywhere, but occasionally you do. And then you get this sort of warm glow of, I guess, nostalgia, yeah.
Yeah, special. So you were keen to go to Yemen, but again, a hot spot when you were there. So how successful were you in that desire?
So Yemen is this very enigmatic region. I mean, I'd always wanted to go to Yemen. I'd wanted to go and see Sana'a and Shibam. But of course, the civil war there, which has been a total disaster for, you know, for the people that live there. There's 8 million people living on the edge of famine and starvation. There's a huge cholera epidemic. Not to mention the fact that civil war has effectively broken the country into this patchwork quilt of basically areas that you simply cannot get to. Al-Qaeda still rule big parts of the central Hadramat region. So I knew it was going to be very difficult to get in. Certainly nigh on impossible to transit the whole country. But I wanted to at least try and tell the story of the people, you know, some people that I met. So when I got to Salalah after the Dhofar, I eventually bumped into this guy who, he was a ethnic Somali, but he'd been living in eastern Yemen as a refugee, and actually now he lives in London. He didn't want to, I had to sort of keep his identity a secret for lots of reasons, but he was willing to take me into eastern Yemen to introduce me to a man called the Sultan, who basically was the son of the last king of eastern Yemen. Even though the Sultanate was actually disbanded in the 1960s, there's still the tribal structure of that part of Yemen. They still call him the Sultan. He's still, you know, the de facto leader, even though the Saudis have put their own proxy leaders in place. So I thought, this really is, you know, an important thing, you know, to be invited by this guy. And so I went in, and you know, it was a very bizarre experience, because myself and Dave, we were the first Westerners to have gone into that part of Yemen in probably 2 or 3 years. They'd not allowed anyone in. The Saudis had blockaded the borders. They'd thrown out all the NGO workers, so there's basically no foreigners in the country. So he said, you can come in as long as you tell our story. And I think it was really important. So we went in, and he'd organised this very bizarre conference. He'd basically booked out a whole hotel in this very remote provincial town in Yemen. So it was 2-star would be pushing it. But he got a conference room. So you can imagine a sort of Middle Eastern conference room. And then he'd invited all of the tribal leaders from all of the valleys and the surrounding lands. And it was like something off Lord of the Rings. You know, all of these basically people with... They looked the part. They all had, you know, they brought their machine guns and their bazookas, and they all had daggers in their belts. So we sat around this conference table, and there was literally machine guns and grenades just stacked up on the table while somebody came around and brought the coffee. You know, it was very, very strange. And they started telling these stories, not just of the modern times, but there's a very strong oral tradition in Yemen. So a lot of the older guys, you know, hark back to when Aden, or what was then called, was a British, you know, colony, a protectorate. And so there's a very strong legacy and a link between not just here in Yemen, but the whole region. So it was interesting to get their perspective on that. Anyway, we ended up getting thrown out of Yemen, not because of these guys, but when I tried to go further west, I wanted to go through the Hadramat, and Everyone said it was very dangerous, but the Sultan said, look, if you want to carry on, I can actually call up Al-Qaeda if you want and see if they will host you. I thought that it was probably a bridge too far with that one. But it was kind of taken out of my hands anyway when the following morning, the Yemen National Newspaper, which is basically propaganda for the Saudi coalition, published a big article all about this British spy that was operating in eastern Yemen. And when I explained to the Sultan that that was highly unlikely, he said, no, they're talking about you. And he said that if we don't leave immediately, they know where I live, they know we've got this hotel, they're probably going to drone strike the hotel. So we left pretty quickly after that. So I had to go back into Oman. He came with me, we just got this convoy and just did a runner across the border and hide out there for a bit. So it was a bit of a detour after that. I couldn't go through Yemen. I don't like flying too much either, so I didn't want to fly over Yemen into Saudi Arabia, so I ended up having to try and find a boat around the coast of Yemen.
Yeah. Did your parents know that you were heading for Somalia?
Well, I didn't know I was heading for Somalia at the time, let alone my parents. No, they didn't have a clue where I was most of the time. But so I found this guy called Aladdin.
Obviously.
And he said he could get me onto a dhow, because all of the big shipping companies, I tried to get onto an oil tanker, and they all said no. So we got on a dhow, like this one of these wooden sailboats, and we sailed from Salalah with the original intention of hoping to try and get up to, if not Saudi Arabia, then at least Djibouti on the Horn of Africa, where I could then get another boat up to Saudi Arabia. The only problem was the guy that owned the boat was a Somali who may or may not have been a pirate himself. And he was in the business of smuggling condensed milk into Somalia. So we got on this boat and turns out we set sail for Somalia. So we got dropped off just off the coast of Somalia, picked up by one of these little speedboat skiffs. I mean, if you've seen, what's that film? Saving Captain Philip. It was a bit like that These guys all armed to the teeth came to the boat. We had to like climb down these ladders, get into the skiff. Nobody spoke any English, but luckily they were pirates. But when you're with the pirates, they're quite friendly. So so we then got. Then they told us to carry on our merry way. So we had to hitchhike across Somalia, up to Somaliland, and then up to Djibouti from there.
Mm. Reading the book that. That boat journey, it's a personal journey for you as well, isn't it? And there are times where it comes through that you're quite forlorn and you're wondering, is this travelling life still for me?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think 5 days at sea on a boat, you know, when you... It was awful. I mean, I don't like boats. There was rats, there was cockroaches. Luckily it wasn't choppy because I get terrible seasickness, but it was just very, very boring. We were almost wanting a pirate attack just to sort of liven things up a bit, but it's just really dull. And when you're in that position, you're not even halfway through the journey at this stage, and emotionally and mentally you think, what on earth am I doing? I'm in the middle of the Gulf of Aden in the most pirate infested waters in the world, and it was just like, I just couldn't.
And also
heading towards Somalia.
And you've got time to think because you're not having to, you know, put this flak jacket on or, you know, go over that into that jeep or whatever.
Yeah, so there's nothing to do. So, there was no electricity on the boat, so we couldn't sort of, you know, recharge your Kindle or anything like that. So, it was a tough time, especially when I got to Somalia and went to Djibouti. And at this stage, we still didn't have visas for Saudi Arabia. So we were stuck in Djibouti for a week. And I don't know if anyone's been to Djibouti, but there's not a lot there.
Anybody been to Djibouti?
I can't imagine the Djibouti Tourist Board is here today, so I can tell them what I think. It was a dump, a complete dump. And what's worse was it used to be a French colony. And so I thought at least there might be a French restaurant. So I found one. It wasn't very nice, but I ordered the filet mignon medium rare, which was a terrible error because I then spent a week unable to move from, I have to say, one of the worst hotels I've ever stayed in.
I mean, this travel, you know, it's fantastic and it's adventurous and you get out there and you get to see it and you get to write books and TV programmes, but does it... It must take a personal toll in terms of when you get back. I mean, do you... now that you've done it a few times, do you see those highs and those lows?
You do. I mean, yeah. I think ever since the Nile, which was 5 years ago now, since I got back, I've kind of been in this sort of almost like we call it in the army the tour mentality. You're away for 6 months, you come back for 6 months, you go away for 6 months, and when you've done five of these back to back, and some of these have lasted much longer than 6 months. The Nile was 9 months. It becomes quite cyclical, and so mentally you have to be prepared that you're going to be going away again for another 6 months. So it's very difficult to reconcile that with friends, with families, with relationships. So it can be quite tough. But no, I can't complain. I mean, I've had it's been a grand adventure the last few years.
So you're in Djibouti, and then where from there?
So from there up to Saudi Arabia, which, having been through Yemen and seen the horror stories there, I almost wanted to dislike Saudi Arabia, having read the news, and there's a lot of stereotypes, and actually I just thought it was going to be a big, empty, barren desert. But actually what I found was, it was actually a bit of a highlight of the journey. One, because I was one of the first people to be allowed to go in as a tourist rather than on a business visa. And two, because actually the people there were incredibly friendly. And you realise, of course, I should know this, that it's usually just the governments and the politicians that stir up the trouble. And actually, the people were very, very kind and very friendly. And it was very unlike what I expected. And also, just from a personal perspective, I'd always wanted to go and see the Hejaz region, which Lawrence of Arabia was one of my inspirations for this journey. And I managed to track down the railway line, which is all but covered in sand now. Nobody goes there because they're not interested. And I was asking my guide, Khaled, I said, I want to go and see this train. He's like, oh, it doesn't exist. It's disappeared now. And I was like, no, I'm pretty sure it's still there, because I'd heard rumours from people, and there were some photos from the 70s from an excavation and so on. But apart from that, there was virtually nothing online. So anyway, I convinced my guide, who was really not up for traipsing along this empty sand-covered railway track. And I found the train that Lawrence of Arabia blew up exactly 100 years before in 1917. And to go and see that as a bit of a wannabe historian was quite something.
Yeah. The footage of you on two wheels when there are actually four wheels and the vehicle, was that Saudi Arabia?
That was Saudi Arabia. It's funny, isn't it, when you've got a country where alcohol is technically banned, people still come up with fun, and that was, they call it sidewalk skiing, and these kids are like 17. Anywhere else they would be professional stunt drivers, but they get the car on two wheels and just drive along the motorway, usually with their mate hanging out the window, and it's absolutely amazing skills. But they made me have a go, so that watch the film for that.
So in this situation, it's slightly different to your other programmes in that you didn't sell the TV programme before you went. But did that actually, in some ways, free you up to do things like that? Because I'm just imagining a BBC or a Channel 4 risk assessment saying, I'm going along on a Land Cruiser on two wheels rather than four. There might be questions raised.
Yeah, I mean, it did free me up in the sense that I could make sensible decisions along the way.
You could make para-type decisions rather than health and safety department-type decisions.
It's led by common sense rather than some lawyer sat at a desk who's never been to the region, doesn't understand the region. So, and the point is, myself and the other guys on the crew are, we've done this a lot. We know what we're doing. And so we're probably the best-placed people to make those decisions. There were lots of decisions where we said, actually, we're not doing that. But we were able to push the boundaries a bit and come away with, I think, some of the most remarkable footage. I mean, this film will be the best out of any that I've made, without a doubt. But it's just a bit annoying that it's quite tricky convincing people in the TV world that it's a good idea to commission it. So
we'll all have to write and tweet and
if you all tweet Channel 4 and tell them that this really should be on the telly. But it's going out internationally anyway, so it's going out globally, but at the moment not here yet.
So after Saudi Arabia you head up through Jordan, which of course is Lawrence of Arabia country as well.
Yeah.
And you have you kind of almost pick a guide at random.
Well, it was bizarre. So I'd already had this... I had a guide lined up for Jordan, and somebody had recommended him. He was a professor at the university in anthropology. He was, you know, on paper, he was amazing. He knew all about the culture and spoke perfect English. But when I sat down, there was this quite meek old man, and I thought, well, doesn't matter, you know, I'm guides come in all different shapes and sizes. But I think there'd been some miscommunication in the emails, because when I explained that I wanted to walk across Jordan, he promptly finished his coffee and did a runner out the back door, which left me in this bar with no guide. I wanted to set off the following day. But it's times like that that you have these amazing serendipitous moments, because I was kind of looking around the bar thinking, what am I going to do next? And in the corner of this bar was this guy with a red bandana. He had black makeup around his eyes, a goatee beard and long curly black hair. I mean, he looked exactly like Captain Jack Sparrow. He was smoking a cigarette and he had a pint of Guinness in the other hand. And I thought, immediately, he's my man. So I just walked up to him and said, excuse me, but do you speak English? And he looked me up and down and said, why not? I thought, okay, that's a good start. So I said, well, I'm doing this journey. I'm going to walk. It's going to take like 3 weeks, whatever. Do you want to come with me? He literally downed his pint, stood up and said, why not? And that was it.
So
and
what was his name?
So Michel. He was a Bedouin nomad. Who just liked a pint or two, as most of them do. And, he was just up for it. And he was born and raised in a cave. He was completely illiterate, but he spoke enough English to get by. But he's great. I mean, the funny thing is, for somebody who's illiterate, we're still friends on Facebook, and we communicate with the sole use of emojis. Yeah.
So... on that journey, you go up to one of the wonders of the world, to Petra and Indiana Jones country.
Yeah.
How did you find that? You've been there before on your
gap year,
haven't you?
I've been there a couple of times, but it was great. You know, I think, you know, to go to Jordan, and that's a place that anyone can go to. It's a wonderful place, very safe. And it's just, it's the Middle East of old. You know, it really is. And it never fails to amaze. So highly recommend anyone to go to Jordan.
Yeah, who's been to Jordan?
Yeah.
Go if you haven't. It's wonderful, absolutely. And then I don't want to do a spoiler, but you walk into Bethlehem.
Well, I had to. I timed it almost like I planned it to get to Bethlehem. This was after like 5 months walking to get to Bethlehem for Christmas Eve. So that's what we did. Walked into Bethlehem, not with a donkey, but we walked across the Judean desert from Jericho, and it was amazing. It was just such a biblical experience to walk across this desert, and you see in the distance where you see the motorway, the busloads of tourists, and we're like, now we're going to walk it. So it was great, and did all the stuff. Went to the Church of the Nativity for the midnight mass at Christmas, and actually I managed to I flew my parents over for that, so that was quite nice.
And also
Alberto,
yeah, and people will remember, I'm sure, from walking the Americas. How's he?
He's all right. Yeah, he's. He's doing all right. He's settled down, shockingly. I'm going to try and get him out on another trip soon. But no, it was great. And then we went all the way through through the West Bank and then into Israel. Went through Jerusalem. And we did New Year's Eve on Tel Aviv on the beach. It was great. And then carried on up through Israel. But, of course, the border, the idea was to finish in a town called Byblos in Lebanon. Mm. Which claims to be the oldest city in the world. And I thought that'd be a nice finish, right on the Mediterranean Sea, looking back towards Europe. But that border has been closed forever, basically. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't go that way. So I had to then take a detour all the way back through Jordan and then run the gauntlet through Syria. So I had to travel through Damascus, Homs, and then get into Lebanon that way. So that came with its own problems.
Mm, I can imagine. Let's get the microphone out, if we may. Stick your hands up if you've got a question for Lev, and Roddy will come and find you. Don't be shy. You can talk about... There's one. We've got one over here, Roddy. Okay, great. Thank you very much. You can talk about anything that you've heard or other questions from other programmes, whatever you like. Go ahead.
Lev, I've finished...
Sorry, where am I looking? Thank you.
I finished 8 years ago, 3 years loan service in Oman. And I sensed a country of great history, culture, and beauty, but a rapidly growing young, well-educated population. And I could see some tension. What was your feeling as you travelled through of the young and the old, and how do you think Oman is going in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, absolutely, not just in Oman. I think that that sense came across most in Saudi Arabia, because I think something like 70% of the population is under 30. So change is coming, whether they like it or not. And I think this new guy is you know, he's treading a fine line. But it's inevitable. I think change is coming across the region slowly. I mean, you get these spurts like the Arab Spring. But since then, and certainly in the last decade, social media and technology has had an enormous impact. People are communicating. Whereas, I mean, I met these guys in Jeddah on the streets, and they were beatboxers, these kids, you know. In Saudi Arabia, you don't expect to meet kids, you know, beatboxing. And I said, you know, like, what's it like being a youngster in Saudi Arabia? And you see the same in places like Oman as well. And they said, well, you know, before we had social media, you only really were allowed to be friends, or you just inevitably were just friends with your extended family, your cousins, you know. Now, they've got these whole online communities, and these kids, they meet up, they chat. And so I think that has had a huge impact on society. And so, like in you go to Muscat and meet the youngsters there, it's the same, I think. There's a very strong conservative element in parts of Oman, in parts of Saudi Arabia, certainly across Yemen, Iraq, but it's just a matter of time, I think. And I don't suspect it will be easy, and there will be lots of conflict internally, but there always has been in the Middle East. There always has been. So it's kind of, on the one hand, quite disheartening to see this, what seems like never-ending conflict in the region, but also hopeful when you meet... I mean, I met some amazing characters who, you know, in spite of some terrible things happening to themselves, to their family... I met in Syria this guy whose father had been killed by ISIS, decapitated at Palmyra. He was the director of antiquities, and his son was there, and I chatted to him. I said, how do you ever get over something like that? How do you forgive these people? Can you forgive these people? And he said, you know what? If I don't forgive them, nobody else is going to. If I don't forgive them, there'll never be peace in this country. I thought that was quite a powerful thing to hear from somebody whose dad had been murdered. So I came away with a sense of hope, despite the tragedy. Yeah.
Okay. Question over here, yeah.
In your experience of travelling, you seem to have manifested great nerve. But was there any time where you genuinely felt afraid for your own life?
Many times, yeah, for sure. I mean, on this trip in particular, probably when we were in Iraq, I mean, we got ambushed by ISIS. We were driving along. I mean, it was our own fault because we were with the Iraqi army moving towards an ISIS town. And then we started getting shot at. So it wasn't a complete surprise. But when something like that happens, you think, okay, it just got real. But often, you know, it's not that... I mean, that, on the one hand, was counterbalanced by the fact that at the same time, as a professional, you're like, actually, this is going to make awesome footage. So that kind of is quite exciting from a journalistic point of view. Sorry, was that mine? But... It's often the more banal things that are really the biggest dangers, the biggest risks. And, you know, we spoke briefly there about risk assessments, and people get all excited about the glamour of getting snapped at by a crocodile, or, you know, or shot at, or having a spear thrown at you. The number of times that actually happens does not warrant the amount of flapping that people do about these sorts of things. If you go to the Middle East, you're not going to get blown up unless you're really, really unlucky. Okay, you're far more likely to get hit by a bus crossing the road, or fall off a motorbike, or just be involved in a car crash. And I found that myself. The one time on all of my travels that I had the biggest danger was when I was in a taxi in Nepal and the brakes failed and went flying off the edge of a cliff. So because of the frequency of events, a risk has to be thought through. It's not just, oh, that sounds dangerous, don't do it. No, it's like, what's the most... frequently, you know, the common occurrences, and it's inevitably going to be a road traffic accident or just eating some dodgy steak in Djibouti and getting ill. You know, that could probably do you as well. So it's just being sensible about it.
other questions. One here, yes. Okay, yeah. Hi, Lev. So through all your journeys, you, I guess, build these like amazing connections with complete strangers. And I wondered if you could talk about how you go about building these connections where sometimes there could be perhaps the uncomfortable expectation of money being exchanged as part of going about those connections.
Money exchange. Well, if I'm taking somebody as a guide, then I'll pay them. So I don't think there's any problem with that. I mean, people aren't going to do this necessarily for free. And I don't like using tour guides. That's not to... Sorry if there's any tour guides. But just because the people that I like to travel with tend to be, you know, ex-soldiers, people who've spent a bit of time in jail, you know, dodgy people, because they're quite interesting characters and they're, you know... And so, and also to give people a chance as well. I genuinely, and this is not me being a do-gooder, but I genuinely think that if somebody has got a good story to tell, regardless of his background or her background, you know, let's get them on. They don't need to know how to use a compass or a map. You know, I'm not a guide. Isn't that's not their job to get you from A to B. I can do that myself. It's there somebody to be the interface between you and the local culture, and it's for them to get you out of trouble when it comes. And I would never ask somebody to do that for free. So I do, you know, I make sure I pay guides and I pay them a good wage because I think it's right across the countries. So I think it's really important. But of course, you know, there are situations when you, well, there's corruption around the world, you know, and you often get to police checkpoints and they're like, okay, let's do this the hard way or the easy way. And it's times like that when you just have to be, you know, have some integrity and be like, okay, let's do it the hard way. I'm not going to pay you anything just to get through a checkpoint. But the point is that the reason you pay a guide to be with you is to get you through those situations. So actually, I've never had to pay any bribes, really. There's been situations where, in Egypt, for instance, there was a situation there, but it wasn't bribery. It was just a big fee to the government for access to places. But apart from that, there's not been any... I've not had to do any backhanders.
It's a question... We're going to come to this little girl... Oh, we're going to go to that little girl
Let's
first.
Speak to the little girl first, yeah. And then... Hello.
What was your favourite holiday and why?
Ooh, that's a very good question. My favourite holiday... Well, I went to Ibiza last summer. Have you ever been there? I like holidays as well. I don't have to go walking all the time. You know, for me, I like to go and see as many different places around the world, anywhere, and I mix it up. You know, sometimes I go and do long walks in the desert. Sometimes I want to go and sit on a beach and you know, make sandcastles. So I'm going to say, although one of my favourite countries is Nepal in the mountains, because I love the mountains. And they've just got very nice sunsets and views. So if you ever get the chance, go and see the Himalayas in Nepal.
Good advice.
How much insight did you get into the life of women in these countries, and how is that changing?
Tinder's not that great in that. I tried where I could to get female guides. My guide in Syria was this amazing lady. She was a grandmother in her 60s. And the reason she was so good was because if I'd have had a male guide in Syria, everyone's affiliated to one group or another, and it'd be very difficult to get access. But because she was this little old lady in a hijab, you know, she was telling these big generals and people at checkpoints to bugger off, you know, and it was great. And people took her seriously. So I tried where I could. There were certain places which you just don't see any women. But in Yemen, there was quite a lot of IDPs, refugees coming from the West, and they were more than happy to. And all of their family, all the males had been killed. It was just big groups of women in Yemen who were happy to, like, you know, they were obviously very upset, but they were more than happy to tell their story and be on camera. And they're like, you know what have we got to lose? We don't care. Show my face. Nothing to lose. So that was what I found. And then you get places like, even in Saudi Arabia, you know, lots of women there were more than coming up to me on the street saying, oh, can you film me? Not what I expected at all. In Jordan, in Lebanon, very, very, very liberal places. In Syria, absolutely very, very liberal. So no problems at all, yeah.
We have to ask, what are you planning and plotting next?
Well, I'm going to go and sit on a beach in Bali, I hope. So if the Indonesian tourist board is around, I'll chat later. And write a book. Something very different. Can't divulge anything yet, but something a bit different, yeah.
Fiction or non-fiction? Or couldn't you possibly say?
Watch this space.
Okay, yeah. We'll leave it there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming. Great questions. Thanks, Leveson, who will be over in the Stanford stand signing. Run, get to the front of the queue. Thank you.
Thank you.